So, good morning. We'll try that again. Good morning. Very good. So welcome, everyone, to this session. We're going to get started. My name is Felicia Mayo, and I'm the head of diversity and inclusion at Tesla. And I'm a Watermark board member as well. And I'll be your session MC for today's session. Okay? Everybody's still coming in. So hopefully we'll have a lively session here. I am thrilled to be here to support the advancement of women leaders from across the state and to support this community. At Tesla, we are committed to ensuring that differences power our innovation to accomplish our mission. Our innovation comes from looking at problems differently and making connections from diverse experiences and perspectives. The Conference for Women offers a blend of practical tools and advice, inspiration, and peer networking. Through a mix of sessions, we are committed to your empowerment to inspire you to make your mark in and for your companies, your careers, and your communities. Thank you for participating in the breakout session, Transform Your Working Life. We have an amazing hour in store for you. Now, I'm excited to introduce Caroline Webb. So Caroline Webb is CEO of Seven Shift, a firm that shows people how to use insights from behavioral science to improve their working life. Her book on that topic, How to Have a Good Day, is being published in 17 languages and more than 60 countries. She is also a senior advisor to McKinsey, where she was previously a partner. An economist by background, she makes extensive use of behavioral science, including behavioral economics, psychology, and neuroscience, to help her clients discover how to be at their best and how to bring out the best of their colleagues in turn. Wow, that's pretty huge. Can't wait to learn all of that. She has co-founded McKinsey's leadership practice and designed the firm's approach to transforming senior team dynamics and improving personal effectiveness. She also founded and remains faculty of McKinsey's flagship leadership development course for senior female executives. She is a founding fellow of the Harvard-affiliated Institute of Coaching and has degrees in economics from Cambridge and Oxford universities. Her work has been widely featured in the media, including the Financial Times, the New York Times, Fast Company, The Economist, Wired, Fortune, Time, Business Insider, The Guardian, and the Harvard Business Review. Please put your hands together and welcome Caroline Webb.
Hello, everybody. Are you having a good day?
Yes.
Fantastic. You may not need me then today. But on the off chance that you need me tomorrow or next week, I'm delighted to be here to share a little bit of what we can all do to transform our working lives day by day, every single day. I should start by acknowledging that despite the fact that I wrote this book, How to Have a Good Day, and I'm very full of optimism about the chances of us being able to do that, not all of my days have, in fact, been good ones. I know, it's shocking. And actually, whenever I'm standing in front of a group of people wearing, you know, I mean, this is not super dressed up, it's, you know, a little bit smarter than I might have been if I'd been sitting on my own. I'm reminded of a day early in my career, which you might have had also. It was the very first day that I was being allowed to give a big presentation, right? I was the person previously who'd been putting together the PowerPoint decks and sitting in the back of the room and hoping my boss didn't screw it up when he was presenting the material. And then there came this point. It was at the end of a project when I was early in my career as a management consultant at McKinsey. And my boss said, I think you're ready. I think it's your turn to stand up and do this final presentation. Maybe not the beginning and the end, but the meat of it. Right. So I thought, well, this is super exciting. I was very excited. I was also a bit nervous. And so I thought quite a lot about how to make sure that all of my slides were neatly organized. And I will say, I said PowerPoint, just to give you a sense of perhaps my age. This was, in fact, the last presentation I ever did on acetate overhead slides. Like, half of you are looking at me like, what is she saying? So, I was organizing all of my physical pieces of plastic to make the presentation. And I'd thought about my outfit. And I didn't always wear heels, but I was wearing heels that day. So, dressed up. And I was also thinking about how to project gravitas and presence into the room, given that I was a bit nervous. And so I had decided that I should stand tall. My mother always told me I tended to slouch a little bit. So I should stand tall, and that I should own the room, you know, by walking around. What? It's entirely reasonable strategy, right? I was walking around, and in my mind, I was indeed owning the room. I had everybody's attention in the palm of my hand. It was a smaller group than this, but it was still a big group for me to kind of have everybody's eyes, you know, looking at me. I'm feeling pretty good about it. Then there was this point where I was making this especially important point, and so I don't know why this seemed like a good idea, but anyway, I took a really, really deliberate, emphatic, bold step into the middle of the room. And as I did that, I heard this crack. So how many of you know what was happening at that moment? Yeah, so the thing is, before it happens, you don't really know it can happen. So it is true that at that moment, it turned out, I learned that it was entirely possible for the heel on a high-heeled shoe to shear off, break off completely. So that was great. And as I was lying on the floor, it turned out to be well-nigh impossible to project any more gravitas and presence into the room. So, you know, there are days that are less than stellar. There are things that we can't control. There are shoes that break, actually rarely shoes that break, especially once you've had it happen once, you know that when your heel is wobbly, you should stop, you should step away from the shoes. I suppose the things that we can't control are more likely to be things to do with technology, things to do with other people, things to do with unforeseen events that move deadlines and change workloads and morph reporting lines and that sort of thing. So there's plenty we can't control, no question. Plenty we can't control in our working lives. But I've always been interested, since about the age of 16, 17, I remember saying that my life philosophy was going to be realistic optimism. And I wrote this in my college yearbook, you know, just the sort of thing you do when you're 17. And I really decided that I was not one of those people who was going to stand in front of the mirror and say, everything is awesome, because plainly it isn't. But I was going to be someone that looked for all of the possibilities within the wiggle room that we have, that acknowledged the challenges we have as human beings, and gave us a way and found a way to kind of go through those challenges or around those challenges. And for me, the toolkit for those going around and through the constraints, quite early in my life, became behavioral science. So, you know, that's the economists, the neuroscientists, the psychologists who are sitting in labs all around the world trying to figure out why we think and feel and behave the way we do. And I think there is real cause for optimism, because the research that these fantastic researchers have done over the last two or three decades points to quite a few really small tweaks that we can make in our everyday working lives that can have disproportionate impact on how it feels at the end of the day. And I wrote a book, as you know, that has maybe 100 of those little science-based tweaks in them. But of course there are favorites. I mean, you know, one doesn't have favorites among one's children, but still, there are some things that I use more than on others, and there are three that I use every single day. And I thought they might be good ones to share with you, because they're certainly what boosts me from day to day. And we can have a conversation about all the others, all the 97 others. But let's start perhaps with three really practical things that really give us a sense that we can control some things in our working life that don't normally feel controllable. And I'm going to start by talking about, first of all, how can we shift the way that we experience reality? Reality seems to kind of happen to us and around us, doesn't it? Or does it? So I'm going to start there. Then I'm going to talk about how we can get more time in the day. That's also something we tend to think is pretty fixed, a fixed constraint. I'm going to talk about how we can get more time in the day. And then I'm going to talk about how we can remote control other people's moods. Yeah. Like I'm remote controlling these slides. Wouldn't that be great, hey? Wouldn't that be great if we could do that? So there are three things that we tend to think are kind of, you know, challenges we have to roll with, three things that behavioral science tells us, actually, you know what, you've got a bit more control than you think. And that control adds up. Does that sound like a reasonable agenda for the next 45 minutes? Excellent. All right. So let's go. Let's talk about how we can edit our reality to have more dogs in hats in general. I just put that photo there because I like it. I like dogs in hats. And I would like my reality to have more dogs in hats in them. Unfortunately, not always possible. But let's see what we can do with realistic optimism, shall we? All right. So let me tell you about a day a bit further on in my career. My shoes were structurally sound. But on this day, it was another big day, another big professional day. It was actually at the beginning of a project rather than the end this time. And I was being put on a project. Like, how many of you have got something on your to-do list that you're not that excited about, that you've been kind of pushed into a little bit by someone else? Yeah, okay, so, and if you don't, then I would like to meet you. So it was that thing that wasn't absolutely the thing that I was super loving about my job. It was a project that my boss had said I should join because I would complement this other person really, really well, this other leader who was heading up the project. His name was Lucas, and he was all over the analysis for this project. It was a huge transformation program of the sort that some of you, I'm sure, are in right now. You know, you have Gantt charts for days, and you have milestones, and it's very, very complicated, and you're trying to juggle 14 work streams to try and get change to happen in your company. So it was that kind of project. And I was a bit dubious about whether it was the right fit for me, because my work was already starting to get a bit more intimate. I was starting to do more coaching, more working with teams and boards and so on, and this was one of these huge projects done mostly through PowerPoint, it felt. So wasn't excited about being on this project with Lucas. Also, this was the first meeting when we were meeting the clients. And I was kind of pissed off. Am I allowed to say that? I was kind of pissed off for a couple of reasons. First of all, I just didn't feel that the meeting was set up for success. You know, we all try to fly less. We all try to travel less. But then in this case, you know, we were doing a video conference with clients, and I felt that we should have, on that occasion, got on a plane and gone to meet them face-to-face, at least for the first meeting, to actually get to know them a bit better, you know, make that human connection, like, you know, I was doing shaking your hand, right? There's something nice about that, that human contact. But it was a video conference, and this had been set up before I came onto the project, and I was not happy about it. I was supposed to bring the people dimension to the project to complement Lucas's very analytical side of things. Actually, side note, only at McKinsey would an economist be brought in to bring the people dimension to a project. So, there I was. I was worried about this. The other thing is, to be perfectly honest, I am not a morning person, and this was 8 a.m., and I am basically non-functional until 10 a.m., more or less. And I've had to kind of accept that. My body wants to go to bed at 3 a.m., and, you know, so I've had to work with that throughout my life, really, really work with that. So I was feeling pretty grumpy as I went into this meeting. Lucas was there with his 300-page PowerPoint deck that he was going to present. The clients were on a screen, like disembodied heads on a, you know, it was just, yeah, really friendly, you know. Low ceiling, dark room, heart sinks as you walk in. So I knew it wasn't going to be a great meeting. And I was right. There was lots of sort of sticky moments where people talked over each other, contradicted each other, lots of frowns. It did not feel like the oomph, fantastic start to a project that we knew we needed. And so afterwards, thinking, well, you know, this is my responsibility. I'm supposed to bring that people dimension. I sat down with Lucas and I said, I thought we got off to a really slightly sticky start with the clients. And he was sitting in the, it was in my office. And he was sitting about as far away, perhaps a little bit closer. And he was just, he wasn't smiling at me like you. He had his arms crossed, and as I was telling him, Lucas, about all the problems that I'd seen in the meeting, he started shaking his head and started saying, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, don't you remember the moments where the client said, this is a great meeting, I'm really looking forward to working with you? He reminded me that we'd laughed about the quality of the coffee that we were drinking, and that, you know, there'd been real laugh-out-loud moments like that. It was kind of weird, because I didn't think he was lying. It was sort of on the edge of my consciousness. But it wasn't my experience of the meeting. And I became very interested in how he'd experienced these 2 hours so differently. And of course, some of it's about personality, but it was literally that he had seen and heard things that I had not seen and heard. His reality in that meeting was fundamentally different to mine. And I became interested in this because I realized it was an example of something that scientists have known about for quite a long time. And the way it works is this. The reason behind our different experience comes down to the way that everyone's brain processes information. So your conscious brain, the conscious part of your brain, the part of the brain you're using to listen to me right now and the part I'm using to speak to you, hopefully, is fantastically intelligent. It's responsible for reasoning and self-control and forward thinking and all of the things that we think of as being adult behavior and that we think of as ourselves, our sense of self. It's the conscious part of our brain. Obviously, there's a huge subconscious, but the conscious part of our brain is what we think of using from day to day, very obviously. And the thing that you want to know here is that the conscious part of your brain, brilliant though it is, can only process a certain amount of information. And if you look around a room like this, not even a room like this, because obviously this is huge, but if you look around any room, there are trillions of pieces of data in the room. And every tiny thing is a piece of data. So every little kink on this delightful carpet is a piece of data. Every hair on the head of the person next to you, don't be scared. Every hair on the head of the person next to you is a piece of data. The way that the light falls on that, is this at all creepy?
No.
The way that the light falls on each hair is a piece of data. Trillions and trillions of pieces of data. Our brains can't handle that. So what happens is that subconsciously, beautiful solution, subconsciously, our brains are filtering out most of what's around us at any given time as irrelevant spam, not needed for the task at hand. You do not actually, although you could if you wanted to, you could look at every contour of every object in your field of vision. You could pay attention to every sensation in your body, but you wouldn't get a lot done, right? So instead of making your brain hang with information overload, you filter out a ton of what's going on around you. So we're all experiencing a sort of incomplete, partial version of reality. And it's interesting because, you know, you think that you're smart, I think that I'm smart, and I'm an objective observer of reality, but there's a lot that I'm missing all the time. It's like we're looking down a pair of binoculars and we see what's in focus and we miss everything else. You kind of know this, right? Because there are things you don't notice from day to day and then suddenly you realize later on they were there all along. So, you know, there was a day when I bought Nike sneakers for the first time, and I don't know why I'd never bought Nike sneakers before in my life, but I was in the Flatiron store in New York, which is where I live, despite my accent. And I went into the Nike store, and I bought these sneakers. I was really, really excited about them because I hadn't bought any sneakers for about 15 years. It turns out technologies move on, and sneakers are much better now. So there I was, came out of the Nike store, super excited about my new sneakers. Suddenly, notice that half of New York is wearing Nike sneakers. How amazing is that? They didn't just buy them. They were there before. And that's how this process works, because there is a rule to the way that our brains decide what's relevant enough for us to see and hear consciously, and what's irrelevant and should be filtered out subconsciously. And it works like this. Whatever is already top of mind for you tells your brain, you should see and hear things that relate to that. So I just bought my Nike sneakers, so suddenly I see Nike sneakers. You buy a new car, you suddenly see cars on the road that are the same model. You decide to make a bold fashion choice in wearing a color you've not worn before and you're not sure suits you, but you're gonna do it. And then you notice everyone else who's wearing that color. So we know that this happens. We know that we might walk down a street and suddenly see an architectural feature that we've never seen before, and yet it's clearly been there for 50 years. We know we don't see everything. But it's more interesting than that, because it's not just buying sneakers or buying a car or wearing a top that is going to change what you perceive. It's much more subtle than that. Anything that's top of mind for us, our aims, our assumptions, our attitude, are going to shift what our brain decides we should see and hear. There's a study that I especially like, which really lays this out. There's a group of radiologists. Radiologists are the people who look at x-rays and MRIs and so on, and they look to see if there's anything wrong. There was a group of radiologists at Harvard who were going through a stack of lung scans, and they were looking for lung nodules. In the last of the lung scans, because this was being done as an experiment, there was a picture of a plastic gorilla inserted in the lung. And the question is, given what I've just said about the fact that what's top of mind will tell us what we should and shouldn't see, how many of the radiologists do you think saw the gorilla? It rounds to none. 83% of them didn't see the gorilla, despite the fact that eye-tracking devices showed that they looked directly at it. Despite the fact that the gorilla wasn't small, it was 44 times the size of the average lung nodule that they were looking for. And despite the fact that these are people who are trained to spot abnormalities. Oh my God. So our brain is capable of filtering out really, really visible, really important information. And it's capable of doing that just because it's trying to help us not get overloaded. It's not even just, you know, specific objects. It is really more subtle than that. There's another study that was done, which involved... Don't ever sign up for a psychology study, by the way, because the things that they make you do... So imagine you've all signed up for a psychology study, and I'm the mad, bad scientist in the white coat. And then I give you all a test, and it's not a big deal. It's not that hard. But I randomly put half of you in a bad mood by telling you you've failed the test. It's no big deal, right? Not biggie. But it's just enough to tick you off just a little bit. You guys, you're great. Then, the real part of the experiment is this. I give you all a neutral description of an individual to read. And you have to tell me how likable this person is. How likable this person is. And what happens? You guys think that this person is perfectly likable. You guys, because you're in a bad mood, perceive this person as less likable. That's how subtle it can be. Our attitude going into something can shape what we're able to perceive. And some of you will have heard of the term confirmation bias and will be thinking, is this related? Yes, it is, absolutely. It's just one example. It is where the assumptions that you have top of mind are what shapes what you perceive. You look for evidence that confirms your expectations. There's a banana on screen because one especially ludicrous example, I think, is another study where a bunch of people were sat in a laboratory and they had to look at a black and white picture of a banana, and then they had to adjust the background to make it match the color of the banana. The power of our brain's ability to see things that we're expecting and ignore everything else meant that even though the black and white, the banana was completely black and white, people adjusted the background so that it was very slightly yellow. So their brains were expecting to see a yellow banana, so they saw it as yellow. Now, you think about me going into the meeting with Lucas, and it starts to become a bit clearer how I might have not had the greatest couple of hours. Because I showed up, I was definitely not in a great mood. I had a ton of expectations about the video conference being a disaster. Everybody's had problems with tech and video conferences, right? So, and I had, actually, if I'm honest, negative assumptions about Lucas and the fact that I thought he might be a bit of a jerk. But, you know, given everything we've just learned about the way selective attention works, of course I was setting myself up to see the things that proved that I was right, that the meeting was going to be a bad meeting. Now, I am not saying that it was the world's best meeting, but I was missing a ton of really important stuff. And now I have a little routine. And it's what I call intention setting. It's the science behind what a lot of New Agey people will describe as intentions. There's good science behind the fact that your starting point as you go into an experience, a meeting, a conversation, will determine to some extent what seems to happen to you. So the way it works for me is this, and I don't always ask myself all of these questions, but I always ask myself at least one of them. And I use some alliteration to try and remind myself of it. So I say, what's my real aim? What do I really want to have top of mind? What's the gorilla I actually want to see? Like, what is it I'm really looking for? And if going into that Lucas meeting, I'd really thought about it, I would have said, actually, my real aim is not to prove this is going to be a terrible meeting. That's a terrible aim. What would I be thinking? My real aim was to bring the people dimension. I would then have seen ways to make people feel comfortable and heard. I would have checked in with my attitude and my assumptions, and I would have said, okay, all right, you're in a bad mood. Not possible to just click your fingers and say, ha ha. But I can say, is my mood serving me? Are my assumptions, my negative assumptions, definitely right? Is there a chance that just today they may not be correct? What would a more positive assumption be? And in this case, a more positive assumption would have been that, okay, suppose the video conference goes terribly wrong. We'll just get on the phone. At least we'll have seen their faces initially, and then we'll figure it out. And then if you don't have time to do any of that, here's your simple, basic question. You're walking into the meeting, you're thinking, ah, crap, I was supposed to do all of that intention setting, and I didn't do that. Your hand's on the door handle. Just ask yourself, where do I want to put my attention? Bizarrely, this is enough to actually put something top of mind for you so that you then see more of it. So in this case, well, actually, going back to the shoe debacle, lying on the floor, I had a choice on what I wanted to notice, where I wanted to put my attention. I could, in that split second, say, I am going to notice everything that suggests that everyone thinks I'm a complete idiot, because I was feeling pretty mortified. Or in that moment, I had just a tiny point of choice to decide to put my attention on the fact that they were laughing warmly, not cruelly, because they were laughing. And I knew enough to understand that they thought it was kind of charming that this very buttoned-up consultant was obviously on her ass on the floor. I can say ass because I've got a British accent, so. So I had a point of choice there, and I could say, I'm going to choose to notice the warmth in their smiles. And I did. I just thought, okay, I understand they're laughing with me. And that was enough to allow me to get back up and carry on. I took my shoes off, obviously, and then carried on. So I'd like to ask you to take a moment to reflect on this, because it means that we all have control over what we perceive to some extent. I'd like to ask you to think about something that's coming up for you in the next day or two, or maybe even this afternoon, and decide, what do you most want to see? What do you most want to look out for? I'd like to give you a minute to talk to the person next to you about that. And I'm doing that partly because I know that you are at least 23% more likely to take stuff away and use it if I ask you to reflect, even if they're tiny, tiny reflections. So, 1 minute to talk to the person next to you. How can you use this? Which question will you ask? And what will you see as a result? Go. Let me rudely interrupt your conversation. I know it's not long enough to talk about the existential nature of reality. But I promise you'll get a chance to carry on talking to your new best friend in a little bit. So, you know, this is something that is helpful to think about. What's your little habit for remembering this? Is it the hand on the door handle as you're walking into a meeting? Is it a morning routine where you ask yourself, what really matters to me today? Therefore, what do I want to really most look out for? I will say that, actually, I use it in a much more fluid way than that. If I notice that I am very grumpy, like because I'm commuting in New York, for example, I notice my mood and I think, okay, I know that by putting good things top of mind, I will magically see more of them. So let me try to see, I'm on the subway, you know, let me try to see three good things in the next 5 minutes. Bloody hell. And it works through gritted teeth. I've noticed. I can vouch for the fact that actually, even if you go into it knowing, oh, you know, I'm in a bad mood, this is really annoying, just by actually looking out for something, like, I love the pink top that woman over there is wearing, or I really like the fact that person is helping someone with a bag. Oh, the humanity, isn't it wonderful? And by just putting these tiny things top of mind, you are hacking the way that selective attention works. You're way more likely then to see another good thing and another good thing. It's the opposite of what our grandmothers called falling out of bed the wrong side, right? You know, our grandmothers were often right. They may not have known the neuroscience behind it, but it turns out they were right. Okay, so let me move on now. If that's very existential, let's talk about something super, super practical. Let's talk about how we can get more time in the day. Who wants more time in the day? Leading question, right? Okay, so I'm going to get you to demonstrate this. I'm going to ask you to count to seven out loud, as fast as you can, with a bit of energy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like this. Some of you might have done this before. It's kind of fun doing it in a big group. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, on my mark. Do you understand what I'm asking? Some of you are like, what is she saying? I can't hear anything through the British accent. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Are you ready? Go. Exactly. It's really cult-like in a group this size. Next, I'd like you to do the same, but with letters. So A, B, C, D, F, G. You ready? As fast as you can, with some panache. Go.
A, B, C, D, F, G.
Ooh, I like the panache. Next, I'd like you to do something that should take about the same amount of time put together. I'd like you to mix them up. So A1, B2, C3. What? Are you ready? Go. Excellent. Give yourselves a round of applause. Yes. The thing is, you may not feel like it, but you actually did it perfectly. You did it perfectly because what you did was demonstrate about 30 years of research into the brain's inability to multitask. Seriously, I know we're women, but it turns out that even for us, it turns out that when we try to do more than one thing at once with our conscious brain, we actually feel, obviously, like we're masters of the universe when we're juggling email and we're on a conference call while we're doing our email. Not anyone would do that, right? You know. As we're juggling all of this stuff that's coming in, we think that we're getting a lot done. We feel super busy. In reality, what happened to you just then is what's happening to us every day. That as our attention is scattered across all of our devices and all of the incoming data, what's actually happening is that we are typically making between 2 and 4 times as many mistakes when we multitask versus single task. We typically slow ourselves down by about 30%. Or, as in your case, you just don't get it done because it's just too hard. And, you know, when you make mistakes in the workplace, you know, typically you'll have to go back and kind of rework and fix them. So actually, you know, that 30% also underestimates what it really feels like if you're making between 2 and 4 times as many mistakes when we are multitasking instead of single tasking. And you might say, well, hang on, I thought I was able to multitask. I thought it was supposed to be a good thing to say in interviews that, you know, I'm a good multitasker. How many of you have said I'm a good multitasker in an interview? Yeah, right, you know. It turns out this is terrible. This is terrible because the way that our brain works is that we can actually only focus on one thing at a time consciously. And so There's a single attentional bottleneck in the brain that switches our attention from one thing to another. When we are doing letters, we have to switch off the letter task and then switch on the number task. And then we switch off the number task and then switch on the letter task. And you get the idea. And in each of those switches, they're small, but they take a bit of time and mental energy. And that's what's adding up to make us less wise, less fast. That's not very good English, but you know what I mean. Slower. It makes us less creative. It actually makes us more stressed. So as we are checking our email, trying to listen to the conference call, browsing for lunch or dinner, I mean research, what's happening is that that's what's going on in our brains too, and that's why we feel so short of time. Well, it's not the only reason, but it's certainly not helping. Because if it turns out that actually we check our smartphones 6,217 times a day on average, just in terms of the taps, this was very recent research trying to get a true picture of what the average person does with their phone in terms of the number of taps and swipes, adding up to 145 minutes a day. It's not just the length of time, because it turns out that every time we get an email that comes in, it's not just that it damages our ability to make good judgments and so forth. It actually also takes us between 15 and 23 minutes to bring our attention back to the train of thought that we had before. No wonder we feel short of time. Now, some of you will have heard this before, because I do feel like I started talking about this about 8 years ago, and I do feel like finally this is starting to become a bit more mainstream. I think a lot of people actually are starting to think about, in their New Year's resolutions, how can I use social media a little less, you know, aggressively throughout the day? How can I think about sustaining my attention? How can I get more what I call single tasking time in my day? And, you know, there are essentially two big pieces of advice. One is, look at the most important thing that you're doing today and figure out how you might be able to go offline, so that you can really bring your whole attention to it. And it's not just a task, actually. Same goes for conversations. There was a study that was actually now several studies that have been done where just having a phone on the table between two people led them to rate the quality of the conversation as less enjoyable and that they were less likely to stay in touch with the stranger they'd just been introduced to. And that's because a fraction of their attention was being split. And so they were a bit less charming. So how can we go offline a little bit more mindfully? How can we use airplane mode on our phones? How can we close down browser tabs? How can we step away from the screen if we need to actually think deeply? And the other big piece of advice that often comes up, and rightly so, is that the more that we can batch together our online time, you know, if we can say, I'm going to blitz my email in the morning, I'm going to blitz it in the evening, it's a little bit easier to go offline in between, because you think, oh, well, I'll get to it. And there is a time when I'm going to blitz the email. And I can vouch for the fact that taking that approach means you get through it a lot quicker because you're not losing as much time switching your attention. But it's hard, isn't it? How many of you have tried to do some stuff like this before? Right, we're all now thinking about this. So how do you actually do it? And I think one of the things that's come out of behavioral science in recent years is we're kind of dumb if we rely on only our self-control, because our self-control is pretty limited. And actually, the thing that we want to do is to hack our environment. We want to hack our environment to make it as easy and as pleasant as possible to do the thing that we say we want to do. And this is definitely where behavioral change science is going. It's saying, let's acknowledge the fact that our brains like to do things that feel easy and rewarding. They will repeat things that feel easy and rewarding. And if you can therefore make it feel easy and rewarding to not be online, you're much more likely to win the game. And so I thought, you know, I might just share with you some of the nudges, as they're called, the nudges that I'm using. Just to give you a sense, I'm not holier than thou. I struggle with this every day. I'm constantly thinking about how can I hack my environment to make it easier to do the things that I say are helpful to do if you want to be as smart and as efficient as possible. So one of the things that I do is, in terms of making it more rewarding, is I put a little timer on my desk. And I use that to count down the number of minutes I've set myself to try to go offline. And I do that because when you get to the end of the time. It feels fantastic. You have this little beeping noise that's effectively like a little pat on the back. Pat, pat, pat. Well done, Caroline. You've just managed to concentrate for 10 minutes. Well, listen, seriously, I mean, when I was writing my book, I thought, oh, I know how to do all of this. Like, I'm going to go offline for 90 minutes. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to write a chapter. It's going to be fantastic. And then I'd notice my hand just crawling towards the mouse to open up all of the browser tabs that I just closed down and open up my phone again. So I thought, OK, well, I have to start with, you know, a bit of a realistic perspective of where I'm at. I have to start with 5 minutes on the timer. And that's something that is really helpful to think about when you're trying to figure out how to change a habit in your life in general. Because if you pick a big, big goal, which is great, but if you only have the big goal and not the small first step, your brain focuses on the fact that you're unlikely to achieve it. How good do you feel when you manage to achieve something you've said you're going to achieve? How shit do you feel when you don't, right? Your brain likes to repeat things that it feels are rewarding. So it's better to pick a tiny, tiny, small goal that is eminently doable, really, truly, truly, no-brainer, possible, feel amazing, and then work from there. So, timer on the desk. Set small, small goals. What's the second one there? Notifications. Right. So notifications. I switch off religiously all the notifications on my phone. Every time I update the software, they come back. So I have to go back and turn all of them off. That's been really helpful. That's been really helpful. I do find that, you know, obviously you need a couple of them. You need a few things like text messages, because that can be your back channel when you're, say, you're going offline, to say, actually, you can reach me by text. And another thing that is really powerful, because we're so social, is to make it feel more rewarding, is to tell people what you're doing. It's to tell people what you're doing. Because a lot of people will be, you know, saying, well, one of the problems with going offline is that I'm constantly in demand and I find it very difficult to actually say no when people are getting in touch with me. So it's helpful to just put a few signals and a few boundaries out there, because most of us don't do that at all. So as simple as what I used to do is putting a post-it note on my laptop saying, thinking time. Putting big headphones on. Like when I'm traveling, I use in-ear headphones. When I'm in the office, I wear enormous headphones that nobody can miss so that everybody can see I'm single-tasking. I'm very jiggy with the autoresponders. Even if I'm just needing to get a bit of quiet time, 45 minutes, I'll put an autoresponder that says, just getting immersed in this report that's due. Back online in an hour. If you need me urgently, text me. We can be a bit bolder about these sorts of things. And then there are sludges. So if nudges are things that make the behavior we want a little easier, a little nicer, sludges are little tweaks that make the behavior we don't want harder and less interesting. So one of the first things that I... what is the first one there? That's right, apps to block access. One of the first things that really helps me is to actually use tech to fight tech. So stay focused is something that I use to block my use of social media during the day. I also use something called inbox when ready, which means that I only get to see my inbox when I press a button. It's a tiny thing, but it's a little bit of extra work. And the little bit of extra work means that I'm less likely to just graze into my email when I'm not even thinking about it. And that makes a lot of difference. What's the next one?
Monochrome screen.
So I've set my phone so that when I press this button 3 times, the phone goes monochrome. And what that means is it's just much less interesting. It's much less, you know, drawing your attention to it. And then you may be noticing that I've actually got this little case that I put my phone in, which I actually just made a couple of days ago. There's an Atlantic article I read, and there's a professor called Marcelo Gorman who recognized that sludges is, you know, probably one of the big growth areas for us to get control of our tech. So he sends these little packs out like this, and then you make it, and then what you do is you put your phone in it when you don't want to use it, and the Velcro is so strong that you really have to pull it, and it makes a noise. So if you're in a meeting pretty great, huh? So these are things that I want to tell you about, because it's not that this is easy, but it's just that it's worth it. And we can think about these sorts of nudges for ourselves. This is me actually making the case a couple of days ago. So I'd like to encourage you to think about, what can you do? Which of these nudges and sludges might you be able to use for yourself to get 5 more minutes of single-tasking time tomorrow? Take a moment to talk to the person next to you about one thing you might be able to do to get 5 more minutes, 10 more minutes of good single-tasking time tomorrow. Okay. Let me gather your attention back. So hold that thought. Hold that thought. Now, next, I'd like to talk about what we can do to improve our interactions with people who might be in a foul mood. And to some extent, we've already talked about some of it, right? I just mentioned that simply not being distracted allows you to bring the fullness of your wonderful personality to the interaction with the person in front of you. And I've already talked about the fact that if you go into a conversation with someone and you assume they're going to be a jerk, you're going to see everything that confirms that they're a jerk, and you could just decide to look for something which confirms that they're a human being instead. And that is going to help. But it is sometimes beyond us to use just those things. And I'm going to talk about one other thing that you can do when you're faced with someone who is not perhaps on their best behavior. And I'm going to recall a day which was in Paris, and I was coaching 4 attorneys. And it was fantastic because there were 3 of them in the room. One of them was late, but that's fine. But they were all being super mutually supportive and lovely. And I was coaching them, but they were coaching each other. It's really great. And then the 4th person came into the room, and she came in like this, which was not so great. Throws herself into the chair, gets her phone out, not in a Velcro case. Says, oh, I can't. She's just making noises for a bit. And then she says, oh, I can't make the next meeting. It's really annoying. It's so annoying. It's really annoying. The stress is just like rippling off her. And I watch in amazement as the other 3 guys in the room all get their phone out and start saying, oh, so annoying. I'm like, oh, for heaven's sake, this is, this is fascinating, right? Because they were fine before. And what's going on is something that you know and I know, which is that our emotions are very, very leaky. We are, as human beings, very, very social creatures, and we are very, very leaky. And if someone comes into a room and they're feeling something very strongly, we'll tend to sync up with them within 5 minutes without even talking to them or even working on the same thing. So that was obviously what was going on here. I was sitting there feeling obviously a bit stressed because this coaching session was about to go very badly wrong. And I was thinking, okay, well, so what can I do? What I can do, I realized at that point, is she's contagious, her emotions are contagious, but so are mine, right? So I can say, what do I want to project into the room? Do I want to project my angst into the room? Or do I want to project something more positive? Can I project something more positive in that moment? I asked myself. And I thought, okay, yes, I can project love. I did not say that out loud to these hard-nosed attorneys. I did not say I'm about to project love at you suckers. But I did say to myself, okay, what can I think of? What can I have in my mind that reminds me of what I love about working with them? Because there was plenty I loved about working with them. And I also knew that visualizing something creates about 60 to 90% of the same brain activity as actually experiencing it. So I knew that actually just sitting there and thinking about what I loved about them was going to have an effect on my actual state of mind. So I did it, sat there, feet on the ground, smile, quiet, just thinking about what I loved, radiating love. And I will say that within a few seconds, and probably not like 10 seconds, but probably within a minute, I felt a settling. There was an ease that came back into the room, and we were able to get back on track and start again. And you might say to me, okay, so you can just decide to project love at someone who's being such a bitch? Maybe you don't say things like that, but certainly there's a bit of an inner voice there, which is like, well, you know, how can I be so nice to someone who's being so annoying? And one of the things that really helped me here was to know something which psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. And the way it works is this. When I turn up and I'm a bit cranky and slow at work, I know it's because I didn't sleep well last night. But if you turn up and you're cranky and slow, I think you're a terrible person. In myself, I attribute bad behavior to bad circumstances. In others, I attribute bad behavior to bad character. That's the attribution error. So I know that there's a good chance that there's a ton of things she's juggling, and that's just what's going on. I know that when people's brains feel even slightly stressed, I know that actually there's less activity in their prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that's responsible for sophisticated behavior and thinking, because they're too busy dealing with a fight, flight, freeze response. And so I know that that's almost certainly what's going on in this case. So I have learned in those circumstances to assume good person, bad circumstances. You do not have to be holier than thou, to be clear. You can make up a silly story about what the circumstances could be, about what's driving her behavior. You can simply say, I think it's possible her cat vomited on her this morning. You don't have to become a psychotherapist. But in that moment, the shift in your demeanor comes from the fact that you suddenly see this person as a human being. And it shifts you towards a sense that there might be a possibility that this is a good person in bad circumstances. It also helps to remember that only 1% of the population is a psychopath. So the chances are her cat really did vomit on her this morning. And in shifting your demeanor, you shift the space between you. And that can be enough to get the conversation back on track. So just to recap, I've talked about three things, tiny things, that we can do each day to improve the way the work feels. I've talked about setting intentions so that you shape the reality that you experience in not just actually the big meetings, but also in the small interactions. I've talked about how you might single task more deliberately and forcefully to get better quality thinking, do things quicker, be more creative, be less stressed. And I've talked about how you might just assume good person, bad circumstances to shift the dynamic in a tricky conversation. And if you can do all of these things every day, then your bad days are going to become better and your good days are going to become even better. And as the writer Annie Dillard says, the way that we spend our days is, of course, the way we spend our lives. Thank you.
So thank you so much to our amazing speaker, Caroline. Let's give her another hand of round of applause. So we only have a couple minutes, so I want to see if there are any questions for Caroline at this time. If so, please come to the mic and ask the questions. I see a lot of people trying to get to lunch now.
That's okay. I'm not offended.
There's reserved seating, I know. Hello? Yeah, any questions? Oh, here we go. It should be on.
Hello?
Can you hear
yes.
me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Ashley. I work at Johnson & Johnson. I have a question for you. You said only one...
It's not on.
This is Ashley at Johnson & Johnson. If you just
chat,
I'll repeat it.
Okay. So you mentioned that about 1% of the population is a psychopath.
Yes.
I feel like I may have encountered one or two in my life.
Yes.
So what do you do in that circumstance?
Yeah, what do you do when you actually do encounter a psychopath? Yeah, I think I've worked with two in my life, and possibly more, but two very clear psychopaths who are low on empathy and high on narcissism. I think that a lot of what we've talked about is actually still relevant. The more that you can set your own intentions and own your own space when you're in conversations with them, the less you'll be battered about by what's going on in their minds. I think that the thing I would add is that clarity becomes very, very important with a psychopath, because they are able to, because they don't play by the same rules, it's not always as easy to rely on the kind of moral and ethical sense of what's right. And so it really helps to keep track of everything that's going on. And to be as factual as you can in your interactions with them. And what that means is, instead of talking about the fact that they always cut you off in the middle of meetings, to talk about something very specific that happened in a meeting that's just happened that they cannot argue with. When I was in the middle of this sentence, you came in halfway through and said XYZ. So it really becomes quite important to focus on the facts as much as possible. And then I think, honestly, you know, there comes a point where the more that you can manage and reduce your exposure to these people, the better. Now, I know that that's easier said than done. But to recognize that actually you're not crazy and that it is helpful to talk to other people about what's going on and then to figure out how to reduce the time that you're interacting with them. Or at least to think about strategies to give yourself a boost around the times that you have to interact with them. I'm very happy to talk about that more, by the way. I'm going to go and do some book signing, but you know, I think it is a really important issue that most of us will encounter one of these people. And I do have a section in the book that's specifically about how to deal with psychopaths, jerks, and serial narcissists. So,
I think we have 2 minutes, and we'll take another question.
I have a question.
Okay, so my question was regarding the time for single tasking.
Yeah.
So how much of that information are you using with employers? Because as you know, a lot of the job descriptions that you go to normally ask for all this multitasking, and that's pretty much what you need to know how to do in order to get the job. So how much are you guys using that research in that area?
Yeah. I think that I feel like there's been a tipping point that's been reached in the last few months, where there seems to be more conversation, finally, about the evidence around single-tasking and multitasking, perhaps triggered by this year's series of New Year's resolutions. But I agree that, you know, for most of us, we're in environments where we're expected to be always on. And I think that what I would encourage you to do is, again, working within the constraints that you have, figure out what it would take for you to get half an hour or 20 minutes of better thinking time. And one of the things that I've seen is that when people do dare to set some boundaries and have conversations with the people around them, it is not as scary and disastrous as you might think. I mean, I have to be a bit bolder than that, really. I've seen it transform the dynamics in a team when people actually decide to open up to their colleagues and say, I'm going to use noise-cancelling headphones so that I can get, you know, deeper focus on the report, because I've heard about this science that says that if you're constantly distracted, then you do less good work. And that is always the angle. It's about performance. It's about doing better work. And if you can go in with that, then I've found that people you know, have really good conversations with their bosses and their colleagues. You lead with performance, not, I would like to be less stressed.
So, and it is now 12:30, so if you have any additional questions, Caroline's actually going to be in the exhibit hall signing books, so you can ask your questions there. Sorry, we ran out of time, but thank you. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.